This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, a professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. Today, I'll be interviewing the authors of the book Text as Data, a New Framework for Machine Learning and the Social Sciences. Natural language processing has become a big new growth area in the social sciences, giving us new ways to explore old questions, as well as raising new questions we may not have thought to explore before. My guests today, Justin Grimmer, Molly Roberts, and Brandon Stewart, have each made computer-assisted text analysis a central role in their research, and have worked together and with other collaborators to make major methodological contributions to this field. Justin is a professor of political science at Stanford who studies Congress and political representation. Molly is a professor of political science at UC San Diego who studies the politics of information with a focus on China. And Brandon is a professor in the sociology department of Princeton University whose research is primarily on statistical methods. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you here. Brandon, why don't you give us an overview for beginners of just, you know, what is text analysis? Is that even the right word to describe what, you know, text as data is the title of your book? Gives us just some simple examples of what it can be used for.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks for having us. I think text as data is a really exciting field. One of the things that's complicated about it is that it gets called many different things in many different places, like, you know, text analysis or text as data, or you can even think of it as like an application of natural language processing, which is the term from computer science. But the core idea is that a lot of political and social interaction happens in text, whether or not that's like writing on the internet or news stories or transcripts of speeches. Like, just a lot of aspects of communication are happening in that way. And so that's a ton of data that we're, you know, potentially not accessing to study the things that we want to study. And so the sort of idea of the text as data movement is, okay, how can we quantify that information and leverage it at scale? And people have been doing things that, you know, you can think about as using text as data for a long time, but for you know, a big period of time, it was very manual in its nature, right? It was sort of individual people coding things by hand, or bored undergraduates flipping through the copies of the New York Times. And the idea is now we have all of these statistical methods, these machine learning methods that can help us work at the scale of millions of documents, or, you know, billions of documents. And so that just opens up whole new avenues. So one of the things I love about this field is that you can use it for like every conceivable application. It really widens what we can study. So for example, Justin and his work has looked at how senators in the US Senate sort of communicate with their constituents and how they frame their sort of representational style. Molly has done great work on censorship in China and propaganda and thinking about how those things, you know, how those things are expressed in text. And so you can really go for like all manner of different applications, going all the way back to one of the earliest applications, which was trying to figure out who wrote the unsigned Federalist Papers, which was actually work done by statisticians in the late 1950s. So, yeah, this is, it's got a long history, but I think it's really come to the fore in the last like 10 years or so.
So the examples you gave were mainly political science. You're in a sociology department. How is this sort of being used across the social sciences and even, you know, in commercial applications?
Yeah, that's totally fair. So I think it works in lots of sociology settings as well. One of the sort of notable early, or two notable early examples, some work by Paul DiMaggio and his co-authors looked at newspaper coverage of the National Endowment for the Arts. And so you can sort of like kind of understand like how an organization is being covered. Another really interesting example is Chris Bale, who's a sociologist at Duke, who wrote a book about the way that different like civil organizations covered Muslims in the period after 9/11. And so again, it's sort of like, you know, you can think about it as capturing something about how different groups are characterized, what they're thinking, how they're acting. And so there's really, you know, it's been used for another great example, some work by Alex Hanna covers like using it as a mechanism to capture protests and like just code up like where are protests happening and what are they about. It obviously also has huge implications in commercial spaces, right? Whether or not that's like writing newspaper articles really quickly and sort of assisting with the production of writing. It could be cases of like tracking sentiment. So, you know, a sort of very common example of this is like managing brands, right? You've got tons of people on Twitter writing all kinds of things about your brand, and you want to know, are people saying things that are like mostly positive or mostly negative? So I think, you know, there's just basically anything you can imagine that's in text, there's, you know, some hope of like leveraging one of these techniques. And I think we're only really scratching the surface of the kinds of things we can learn.
So who's the audience of this book then, do you think? Who'd you have in mind when you wrote it as kind of the typical reader?
So I don't want to monopolize the conversation. So I'll take this last one. But I think we really see it as aimed at three distinct audiences. So there are social scientists who really want to learn how this stuff can help them study what they want to study. There's computer scientists who are increasingly, and like folks in industry who are increasingly studying social things and like might benefit from the social science and research design perspective that is, you know, covering, focusing on different things than maybe, you know, have been focused on in the past. And then the third category is the area of digital humanities, which are the folks in literature, in art, in archaeology, in like history that are thinking about the way that we can leverage these kinds of digital techniques. And so there's a whole rich history there that has kind of developed in parallel with the work in social sciences. And so we think that there's lots of useful things to say to that group as well.
Okay, so in your book, you getting sort of more into the meat of it, you outline five key tasks. So why don't Justin or Molly, why don't we have one of you tell us what those key tasks are, and then maybe give an example, you know, more concretely of like, you know, one of the major methods. I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting about your book, to back up a little bit, is that, you know, you take an approach of like, how do we approach the research process? What are the tasks? And you organize the book around that. rather than, you know, like, okay, here's method one, please study this, here's the statistical properties, you know, here's the code that you need to do it, here's method two and its properties and the code needed to do it, and then go on to suggest how it might be useful. You start with the uses and then, you know, mention the different techniques in the context of that. So, So what are the key tasks? Justin, I'll go for you.
Yeah, great. So as you mentioned, a real focus of this book is thinking about putting this text as data into the social science research stream. And so as we were developing this book, we self-consciously wanted to be distinct from how many of these methods have been taught traditionally. And a lot of the organization of the methods comes from computer science, where computer scientists are thinking of the sorts of engineering tasks the methods are designed to do. If they're looking to, you know, subsidize hand coding and supervise learning, so they'll organize things in that way. Or if they're looking to discover patterns, they'll think about it as an unsupervised clustering method and they'll organize it that way. Instead, we wanted to think through what happens when we write research projects. So the first task that we described was about discovery. And this is, I think it's interesting. We spend a lot of time, particularly when we're in grad school, trying to figure out what we're going to write about and what we're going to say, what new insight we have into the world. And usually we think about that as being separate from statistical methods that we might use. You know, the sort of iconic view of this is that you lock yourself in the library for a year and you come out with some brilliant idea that's going to sustain the early part of your career. And we think that's exactly wrong. We think discovery, this early stage where we're trying to figure out what's in our data or what we might have to say about the world or some new way of looking at the world, can benefit a lot from statistical methods. And so there we talk about methods, like I said before, clustering methods. And so if we think about what clustering methods are, they're an unsupervised method. It doesn't require us to define a set of categories beforehand. Instead, they're just sort of emerging from the method, from the data. And this has been used in the past. I've used it with Gary King, for example, to uncover an interesting categorization of congressional speech, or I think interesting, where people are taunting the other side. That's the thing that sort of emerges from the data. Then, having discovered some organization, we think about trying to come up with some measurement in line with that organization. And so measurement is a more tried and true task. We often think about it when we're doing things like estimating the location of candidates in some sort of ideal point space, so their political positions. And so here we're thinking about measurement as a way in which we can say we know some organization that's put in place and we're going to use statistical methods in order to do this efficiently. So a classic example of this is when we're hiring undergraduates to code along some sort of categorization scheme. We might think that's going to take a lot of money or a lot of pizza or a lot of money to buy pizza. And undergraduates are notoriously fickle in their time and their interest in working on a project. And so we might think we can only get them for some small amount of time. And so if that's the case, we describe how statistical methods can be used in order to extrapolate from what those undergraduates did for us to categorize documents generally into a set of categories. And so then with those sorts of measurements in hand and having discovered some organization, we think about a couple key tasks that build on this. And I think one of the distinct things about this book, and indeed kind of the reason it took us the length of time it took us to produce this book, is that we have an extensive component in the book dedicated to causal inference. That is, we say we measure something about the world. We want to know if there's some intervention. How does that affect either the things people say, or if we have some text-based intervention, like an advertisement, for example, how does that affect what people do? And we spend a good deal of time discussing that. And also prediction turns out to be another big component of the way text methods are used. And this can be used either to, you know, use text in order to literally predict the future. You know, there's a lot of coverage of an ill-fated hedge fund that relied upon Twitter for a while. But more generally than that, we can think about using the content of Google searches in order to understand the extent level of flu, et cetera. So these are the key tasks that we're organized the book around. And we really think about this sort of cycle as cyclical, where we work through discovery. This leads to measurement, which leads us to think about prediction and inference, and then sort of feeds back on itself.
So how does this depart from the kind of elementary school version of the scientific method? You know, there you were describing kind of one variant of that, kind of the grad school version of immerse yourself in the books. But you know, the other version is like you I don't know, from maybe a literature or like some book you read, you have a hypothesis about the world or a theory about the world, which generates a hypothesis, which is then something that, you know, then you write down very carefully in a paper and you say, you know, I hate this way of writing it, but you know, it's like the H1, here's H1 hypothesis, here's H2, here's H3. They just emerged from space and then, whoa, a data set came up that perfectly allowed me to answer them and I have statistical significance for all of them. So why is that not the right way to do things though? Sounds so pure.
So you know, at the start of it, that you know, I always think about the old mnemonic. So we have this observe component, and what the heck does that mean? Like, some of it's about us being sort of situated in some social space because we're social scientists and we look out at the world. But I guess me personally, I'm just not that smart. Where I'm just out looking at the world and I can just see the patterns and be like, aha, these are the hypotheses that exist and this is the way things should be, and so. Part of discovery is helping us be better at that observation component. And then another component of this, really, again, sort of reflecting the experience I think we've all had with research, is that once you have something from that observation, you have a hypothesis, you put it towards data, you're going to be surprised. No one is perfect at predicting the results or anticipating what people are going to do. And given that level of surprise, it almost always suggests another study that can be done. And because it suggests this new study that can be done, we can think about this in this really sequential way. So we have some initial observation leads us to conduct some study based on some measurements. We have some observation and that comes from that leads us to another study. And by the end of that, as we aggregate those studies up, we're in a very inductive way, we reach a conclusion based upon the content of those studies. And of course, there's a whole bunch of reasons why we might think induction is a bad word within the social sciences. A focus of the book is to say that this isn't necessarily the case. A lot of the sorts of rules about induction being bad came from a time when data was really scarce. So if you're in a situation where it's the 1950s and you get one survey every 4 years, you need to construct a lot of rules to make sure people aren't going to go out and do an incredible amount of p-hacking and you know, fitting the exact right regression based on repeated interactions with that data. Now we're in a situation where we're flooded with survey data, we're flooded with text data, and the result of that is that we can think sequentially. We can say we have some idea. We can rather cheaply apply that idea to some data. We can test it. We can see some results. And then we could say, well, let's do that again. Let's either get some new text data or we'll take the conclusions from our text data and apply it to some other situation. And that sequence means that we can build inductively rather than, I think, the standard deduction approach.
That does seem to be, I mean, I get, you know, you're framing it as being in the past, and that's partly true. But I think it also is, I guess, maybe inherent in your main data source being text that it tends to be so rich. You know, I mean, we have, you know, people here who, you know, go out and do like a field experiment in Tanzania or whatever. And like, there's only so many villages they can afford to do that experiment in. And, you know, the even like tracking down the same people 5 years later might be tough. So if they can handle that, that's great. And then, you know, then that worry is I'm just going to like plunge in there and I'm going to keep running regressions until I get stars. And then I'm going to say I found something. So anyway, maybe that's a whole separate debate, I guess, but I just want to highlight that, like, I still think for many of us and across many different social science disciplines, we're still in the world where that data is scarce enough that we face a difficult challenge in, like, how to, you know, best make use of the data we have without just, you know, p-hacking our way into some result which no one could ever reproduce again. But yeah, in your world, you know, if there's so much data, we can always, you know, just do the same study again, or, you know, hold out part of our data. I guess that puts you in a very different it just changes the mindset very, very substantially.
So I would just say that even in the world where you're running the field experiment in Tanzania, the theory of experiments is that we get to run the experiment many times. And or that you have such a massive sample that you have you're going to get a consistent estimator from the experiment. And so a lot of the pre-analysis plan and other sort of world there is an attempt to approximate the world we should be in, which is that we could repeatedly run the experiment in order to guard against, you know, just a bad draw on any one result.
Right, for sure. I mean, yeah, you know, that's part of the problem is then, you know, you get one chance, and if you don't get statistically significant results the first time, no one's going to go back and replicate it. So you have to get results, but then there's this weird pressure to like keep looking for stuff. And plus, even if you do get results, you know, there's this kind of, it's sometimes some people even, you know, get a little bit resentful if you go back and actually, you know, run the experiment again in exactly the same way and find something different and say, oh, well, I found something different, you know, either in a different country or even in the same country. Or if you do it in the exact same country, people are like, what are you doing this derivative work for? Anyway, but maybe that's too far off topic. But I agree. We all have the, you know, the same ideal and yes, you know, the replication and, but I think as a day-to-day practical matter, I think the world with Texas data in many applications, I can see it really pushes aside a lot of the challenges that are faced in the kind of the small data world. So you give six key principles for text analysis, is another guiding thing. I can see you guys going back and flipping through your own book there to make sure like, what were my six principles? I have video, but for the audience's benefit, I have video so I can see them, but no, there's not a video that you'll be able to see. So I'm outing them here. I shouldn't have. Why don't you guys tell me, Molly, what is your favorite principle that, or maybe what principle do you find most challenging to convey to students? Tell us about it and how you explain it to people, why it's important.
Yeah, so I think my favorite and most challenging principle, it sort of builds off of what Justin was just talking about, which is that the best method depends on the task. I find that the most difficult to teach, and it's also the reason why we structured the book in this way. I think one of the things that we talk about in the book is that a lot of these methods were developed for prediction or were developed for tasks that social scientists don't do very much. And therefore, when we take them to social science research, we actually need to like rethink about the way that they're used in order to make them relevant to the tasks that we want to do. And I think that every time I sit down with someone interested in using text as data, the first thing we always do is we try to figure out what task they want to do, what type of task. Is it that they have a new data set, they don't know what's in it, they're trying to define what they can measure, then we're in discovery, right? Then it's like, okay, let's think about how we can use an unsupervised method to sort of explore the data, to try to understand what concepts might come from the data, what things could be tested within the data. Or are we asking a very specific causal question about how did this intervention affect writing, or how did some particular writing affect, you know, opinion or something like that, then we're really in this causal situation where we might need to figure out like exactly what we need to measure from the text still, but it's a very different situation than we would be, say, at the discovery stage. And so I think that making sure that, you know, understanding what task and what part of the book we're in is really the first and most important part of starting social science research with text as data. And we talk a lot about in the book how you would approach each of these tasks very differently depending on if you're figuring out how to do the most accurate measurement versus if you're trying to figure out what the measure should be in the first place, for example.
Jumping off that, you mentioned, you know, that these texts techniques were primarily developed by computer scientists for sort of a different set of tasks. Just to give context, like what were they doing with this stuff, and how does that? What are kind of typical things they'd be up to, and what sort of things do you talk about that are, you know, alien or a surprise to them when you meet up and explain what you're doing?
Yeah, so I think one of the big differences that we reflect on a lot within the book is this difference between trying to make a causal claim versus trying to do prediction. So a lot of what these tools have been designed to do in the first place, the tools that we're originally coming from NLP the computer science literature are designed to make predictions based off of text. So that could be some of what Justin was talking about, like using social media to predict how well the stock market's going to do or how well a particular political candidate is going to do, et cetera. And it would be a problem to apply that method in the same way to a causal question. So say I wanted to ask a different, I could use Twitter to say predict how well a political candidate is going to do. So how many votes they're going to get in the next election. Or I could ask a different causal question was how do Twitter posts affect people's opinion about a political candidate or affect people's vote choice about a political candidate? And those are two extremely different questions. One, in the causal question where you're saying, how does this text affect someone? You're trying to ask if the person had seen a different text or had not seen a text, how would they have voted differently? You're asking a counterfactual question. In the prediction question, you're using all information about the text to make the prediction of votes. And that might not be actually a causal story at all. That information that you're using in for prediction might just be something about auxiliary that is actually very predictive, but not causal. And conflating those two can get you the wrong answer. If you decide you're going to use methods that really are about causal inference to do prediction, you can have very low predictive power. If you decide you're going to use methods that are focused on prediction to do causal inference, you can run into a lot of other problems like having a lot of confounding, not having a good design, having post-treatment variables in your analysis. And so you can end up getting the wrong answer there too. And so we talk a lot about how you have to really think about what question you're asking, what you're trying to get at in order to figure out what the right method is.
So what would be a good example of sort of someone coming at it with a prediction background and thinking that they were asking the question the right way, but then, you mentioned sort of, generally like, wrongness. I mean, well, the example, I've talked a lot to the, economists working in the tech sector, and sort of the common kind of example they would come up is, who do we predict is most likely to buy this product? And then, that's a valid question, a prediction question, but then you might jump to the causal conclusion that like, I should show this person the ad. Whereas actually what you really want is the ad going to make this person buy the product? So that's a very, straight up commercial question and application. So in your world, what would be sort of, is there any kind of analogous or easily understood like classical thing where like your first instinct would be like, oh yeah, I've predicted this and therefore I have the answer, when actually you needed to rethink your design and make it causal?
Yeah, so it's hard to, what's a good example of this? And Brandon, Justin, feel free to give a really good one off the top of your head. I think, in the example I was just using, you might think that mentions of a particular political candidate or something were very, predictive of lots of votes for them, but would sort of just the word mentioning that political candidate actually cause in a Twitter post actually cause someone to vote more for that person is a question that wouldn't be answered from that analysis. So one of the things, text is very high dimensional, so you could find certain words or combination of words or topics that are very predictive of a particular phenomenon, but wouldn't necessarily cause it. Another example of this is in, Google flu trends, right? Which is an example of nowcasting, where if people are searching for something online, so you get a whole bunch of searches for flu medicine, et cetera, it could be a really good predictor of flu within that area. And that's like a nowcasting example because the causal arrow is going the other direction, right? Is that the incidence of flu in that area is causing people to search for flu, right? Or flu related medicine rather than flu-related medicine causing people to get the flu. And so that prediction is sort of swapped in a sense. And so you wouldn't want to infer, for example, that searches for flu medicine caused people to get the flu.
Right. Yeah. And I guess thinking about like, you know, even maybe more closely hewing to the advertising example, what you said, like, you know, if certain words are used frequently, or even if they're just like, say, a lot of tweets about a politician that maybe is associated with them winning because they're getting a lot of attention, but maybe all the tweets are, you know, hate tweets from the other side or something, would be, I guess, maybe a really simple example of where you could get confused and think, oh, we just need to generate more Twitter buzz and all publicity is good publicity, when maybe it's not. So that was one of your key principles. What's another good one that that people tend to get wrong? Brandon, should we cycle back to you to give Molly a break?
Yeah, it sounds great. So I think one of the ones that I like but find very challenging to teach is validations are essential and depend on the theory and the task. So this is our sort of one of the points that we make in the book is the idea that unlike a lot of procedures that you might think of in statistics, when you get a particular result, the validity of that result isn't really like justified by the procedure itself. The procedure is just a convenient mechanism for getting something that's interesting. But like we don't believe that these are like true like structural models of the world, as you might have like structural models in like economics, for example. Instead, right, we need to do these kind of post hoc validations to show that the information we're recovering is interesting and valuable as a measurement, as a piece of discovery, as a tool for causal inference. And so the question inevitably that you get from students is, okay, well, tell me what validations to do. Or, you know, tell me like what's the checklist? What's the rule of thumb that does this? And the problem is that the more routinized the validations are, often the less helpful they are, because the less tuned they are to the particular task that you're doing and the particular context of what you're studying. And so, you know, there's some good principles for thinking about this, right? Like you always want some balance in text methods of recovering things that you are really confident are true, while also telling you new things you didn't know. There's a sense in which going back and reading the text is always super important. You want sort of people going in and like seriously engaging with the documents to understand what's happening. But it's always just very challenging because it's so specific to the particular area you're working in. So I'll give an example that I really like from Justin's work on press releases with U.S. senators. One of the things he looks at when he's characterizing the topics of these press releases is, you know, do committee chairs in the Senate talk more about their issue than other senators? Do senators from states with a lot of public land talk more about the public land topic? Right? These are just kind of baseline things that demonstrate that the topic model is really picking up something about the press releases that are important. But then you're able to like push beyond that. But there's no set of rules we could write down that would like lead you to the public land strategy or the committee chair strategy, right? Because it's so specific to the particular thing he's studying. And so to me, that's the biggest challenge. And I think it really goes back to one of the things Justin talked about before about how we're sort of talking about like, how do we do methods in this era of abundance instead of the era of scarcity? And one of the things about the era of scarcity was that you got a lot more of these circumstances where the whole field would get together and collaborate on a measurement instrument, right? So everyone gets together and puts together the American National Election Survey or the Panel Study of Income Dynamics. And so that validation effort is spread across the whole community. Like lots of people are working on making sure these questions are asked in the right way and they're capturing the right thing. But the power of text as data is that it allows for customized measurement that we as individual scholars can choose to study the thing we want to study. And that's great because it means that, you know, we don't have to produce buy-in to convince people to put a question on the ANES, but it also means that the validation's up to us. And I think these kinds of like high stakes, open-ended things like this that involve a lot of work on the back end of the study are, you know, they're hard sell to anyone, but particularly, you know, graduate students who like really need to publish some papers quickly.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I did notice in what you were saying and in the book in a few places you were setting yourself against a framework of there being sort of a true model that we're trying of the data that we're trying to recover that from. I'd like to hear more about that, because actually what you're saying seems, you know, very similar to how I was trained both in political science and economics, you know, how to think about models of all sorts. So, you know, so whether it's a statistical model, you know, if I run a regression on something and draw a line through some points, I don't really think the line is the true thing. I just think it's a reasonably good, you know, summary of like what's going on, or maybe it's, or, you know, which may or may not even be causal, but like, you know, at least some basic sense of like, okay, when this gets bigger, this also gets bigger, but not in a, but that's not the true model. There's lots of ways you could do it. And also like, you know, in game theoretic model, there's, you know, the way I've tended to sort of, I've come down on the story of, you know, thinking of them as parables, right? So there's a, it's a thing that captures something important about the world or about a phenomenon. But not everything. And even like structural modelers in industrial organization, you know, they're looking at monopolies or whatever. I don't think they're, you know, I guess I come back to, you know, there was a ancient or old Jorge Luis Borges story about there, you know, this country that tried to make a map, the most perfect map, and the map eventually became the entire world, because if you want to map the entire world, it needs to be as big as the entire world and have every single feature, and their whole country was, I think, smothered under this map. So, you know, we can't build that map, so we're trying to build maps that are useful for the purpose they're at. But tell me more about, like, so who is it who doesn't think that? Or you know, what's, and I'm probably, I don't want to misrepresent what they're saying or what you're saying, but like, who are you fighting with here?
I don't know if we're fighting with them, but we have a I think a nice point of disagreement. And so perhaps, and Molly and Brandon should correct me if I get the sort of specifics of the sort of sources of disagreement wrong. There's a really nice articulation of, I think, an alternative view from Arthur Sperling and Matt Denny in a nice paper that's about how to think about pre-processing text. And to get really at the core of where the dispute comes down to is whether we can use quantitative measures that are direct consequences of the model to validate things like topic models and clustering models and supervised methods. And if it is the case that we think a clustering model, where we're just going to sort documents into categories where we haven't pre-specified those categories, if it's uncovering some true underlying fact about the world where we really believe that we've uncovered the right objective function and the right way we're going to do optimization so that this organization corresponds exactly to the organization we are seeking, then it is the case that we can use statistics from that exercise in order to adjudicate between different models that we may want to use. And so you are getting a lot of juice for that squeeze, if that makes sense, if you make that assumption. At the core of our view, though, where we draw the distinction, is that even though we think it's useful to write down an objective function that defines what it means for a clustering to be good or not good, or how it is we think optimization should proceed, we think that the end result of that only sort of approximates the thing that the researcher had in mind, and that those statistics then are necessarily limited. And so that's where we, that's why we rely so strongly on these validations, because these validations help us to construct evaluations that are closely tied to the substantive way that we want to use these models. And so this general sort of model-based skepticism then leads us to this whole framework of evaluation, where it's really about evaluating the models in a context where we're going to use the models, or in a way in which we're going to use the models.
I think one of the challenges too that is that multiple paths will lead you to sort of thinking about it like there's a true answer, right? So if you know, you look in the computer science literature, a lot of times they are just trying to get the model that like fits the data well in terms of like holding out data and doing a prediction on it. And so from that answer, that sense, there is like a sort of right answer in the sense that for our particular corpus size, like we can, you know, choose some parameters that will get you the best prediction, but the best prediction doesn't necessarily accord with our like substantive goals. The other direction you can kind of get to this same place is folks that look at this and think about it more like they think about, you know, regression or things like that, then they think about it like reading, right? And so, you know, there are some classes on regression, right, that kind of take this like agnostic approach of we're just like approximating a thing with a line. But there's lots of other kind of takes that people have in teaching where it's, you know, it's more like, oh, okay, we're going to like really believe in this like linear model and we need to pick, you know, the right statistical model. And so I sometimes see like, you know, this kind of yearning for a little bit more clarity that students want to have about like what the right answer is. But the funny thing, of course, is if you think about it like reading, if you sat down and you said, what is the right way to organize these texts, or what is the right way to read this document, people would like look at you like you're crazy, right? Like it just, there's something about the abstraction of the thing into data that I think tricks people into thinking sometimes that there's cleaner answers than there are. And so the key is like, once you pin down what you're trying to do, we can have a serious conversation about how well you're doing that. But before you've pinned down what you're trying to do, there's like lots of things you can do with documents. There's lots of things we could measure in it. So that's, you know, I don't know if that's like fighting with a particular philosophical camp, but I think maybe that's some explanation of like how people come in thinking there's going to be a single right answer when you look at it from the perspective of reading, there fairly obviously isn't going to be.
Yeah, I guess it's right. We have sort of two brains. We have the brain that's trained in our statistics class where maybe there, you know, is, or in a natural science class where there's something pretty close to a right answer, at least, you know, at the scale you're looking at, you know, and whatever, you know, you're going to put these two chemicals together and a certain thing's going to happen. But versus like, I guess, you know, any of us who've had, you know, high school English, right? Like it's sort of, you know, you read a book and it's like, what is the true meaning of the book? Well, there's what the author thought when, you know, she was writing the book. And then there's what this person thought 100 years later. And then there's interesting questions about, you know, how the text in the book relates to the cultural and historical context that it happened. And then there's, you know, another way that, you know, now we read the book and we, you know, notice things or, you know, that are completely different about it and find it meaningful for totally different reasons, I guess. Yeah. So we're sort of much more open to, you know, I mean, I'll admit, you know, it took me a while to learn this. Like specifically in high school, like I was like, oh, I found something the author wrote where he said what he really meant. It's like, okay, now I know the answer. There's the answer. And like, you know, my English teachers and later English professors and the couple of, you know, college classes I took, they're like, no, that's not really how it works for us anymore. There's not one answer. And clearly for social phenomena, and then, yeah, it depends. Yeah. How it, yeah. What you're really trying, right. What the objective of your thing, your research is. So why don't we, as the last thing, maybe dig into one more of your research projects. It's just sort of an illustration of the technique, in action. Molly, do you want to go ahead with something maybe that you're working on? I think the one that I, you know, in the book you've described some projects that I know very well. Is there anything newer that you're working on that you could talk about just as an illustration of some of these concepts and how it's come up?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like writing this book was so useful in my own work because it gave me a roadmap that I go back to now. And, you know, especially, you know, writing it with Brandon and Justin and kind of setting this roadmap down is now something that I go back to a lot. So, just an example of work, recent work that I know we've talked about before, Peter. I have been involved in working on this very, very large corpus of text data that's been made available by the Supreme People's Court in China online, billions and millions of descriptions of legal cases. And this is this amazing corpus and an amazing sort of effort in transparency by the legal system in China. And we've been trying to understand what this can tell us about. And so I've been collaborating with some legal scholars, Rachel Stern and Ben Liebman, to better understand this. And it's been very much the same process. And a lot of the discovery and measurement tasks that we talk about within this book, because so if you have, you know, millions of administrative legal cases that no one has ever, I mean, people have looked at maybe one by one, but not really looked at scale. All of a sudden, you have to ask the question, well, what is in this? You know, what are the things, what are the topics and the types of cases? And it's a huge effort in discovery. And so we ended up relying a lot on topic models in conjunction with close reading of these cases. So sort of to organize these cases to try to better understand what is even in this data. You know, what are the types of things that people are, you know, suing the government about within China? What are the types of things that people, the civil cases that are coming up, what types of criminal cases are people convicted in versus not convicted? There's so many questions that you can ask. So that are both measurement, discovery, prediction, et cetera. So I'll give you one example. So we did this big topic model of administrative legal cases. So these are cases where people are suing mostly local governments about different issues. And we found that there were a whole bunch of cases where people, the actual target of the case is not the government, even though they are technically suing the government, but it's actually some other third party. So they're trying to sue the government to find more information so that they can then use it later in a civil case against another party, or they're trying to get the government to do something against another party. And so that was sort of surprising. It was maybe like a third of these cases that were about this, really about another party. And in the Chinese politics literature, administrative cases have often been used as like a proxy, the number of administrative cases for sort of discontent against the government. But if so many of these cases are actually really about third parties, maybe that measure is not quite right. And nobody had really ever looked at this at scale before because this data had never been available. So I think that's just one example of just even just starting at discovery, just trying to figure out what are the things we can measure and then saying, okay, we want to measure this one thing. You know, how many cases are about a third party, and so how would we do that with text? And we didn't even get to we didn't get to the causal and prediction steps. Just doing that in its own right was interesting enough.
Right, and I guess that's kind of a challenge within social science because we sort of have, rightfully, you know, there's the good thing is recognizing what, you know, to be very clear about when you're talking about like just a correlation or a statistical relationship or description or a measurement versus when you're making a causal claim and being a little bit stricter with ourselves about that. But then I think that's also pushed people away from doing, you know, that kind of descriptive work like you described, just figuring out like, oh, you thought that these cases were mostly about this, but actually they're mostly about something totally different, or not mostly, or at least a big chunk of them they're not the thing you think they were. You know, you looked at, you know, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, in a sense, it's kind of a misquantification because people were coding, you know, every administrative case I see must be someone fighting back against the man, when actually it was like someone trying to get, you know, the party to kind of help them out in their own fight with some other ordinary person.
Right. I think that's a kind of an interesting aspect of the way that social science research is changing. I think You know, in the past, there sort of used to be this sort of conflict between qualitative and quantitative scholars in the social sciences. And I think that with text as data and with some of these other methods, I see that conflict sort of disappearing, right? You have to have this sort of deep reading, this understanding of the context. And this is another one of our principles, is like substantive knowledge is essential for research design, and close reading is really important. So you have to have this context and this knowledge in order to understand what's going on within the text and to use the tool well. At the same time, the tool itself can help sort of organize that process. And I also think that it can push us less toward, you know, always having to have a causal question in the social sciences, to sort of being able to make some descriptive claims that are very important in their own right. So, which I think is really important in the social sciences. We don't always have to have a causal question. We can make a lot of progress making discoveries about organizations of concepts, and also making good measurement. And that's something that the qualitative literature has done well in the past.
Yeah, that was good. It's definitely a different approach. I mean, it's sort of thinking like, yeah, in I'd say the old days version of, you know, there'd be the person who had their data and they ran their regression, and then the qualitative scholar would be like, well, I feel like it works differently than that. When I actually go and like talk to people in the country, and I met with a couple hundred of them, it's like, well, but I have my survey of 2000. So therefore, you know, and I've got p-values, so, you know, screw you. And it would, yeah, kind of, you know, never the two sides would meet. So it's nice to hear that, that you see, this text analysis and, you know, especially the process of validation, as a validation, you know, thinking about what you're really measuring as an important way for these two approaches to kind of recognize their common aims, which I think always were common aims, but also maybe or common value to each other. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. So maybe one last question, I guess, which we addressed a little bit before, but like, I was thinking, you know, economists love quantifying things. That's like kind of their self-description in many ways. You know, it's no longer, you know, a long, long time ago it was about money, but now it's like, it's not about money. It's just about anything, you know, anything I can do, you know, I can look, you know, I could go and look at Congress or, you know, Chinese censorship or, you know, whatever you want, as long as I can like either have a game theoretic model or have some data about it. But despite this love, I feel like text as data has not been as big a thing in economics. Do you have, is that also your sense? Or do you have any idea why that is?
So, maybe a cross plug here. So with, Steve Davis at the Hoover Institution, we run a, once a month text workshop. And obviously Steve Davis is a very prominent macroeconomist who has also done a lot with text data. And he has used text data to do things like measure policy uncertainty and the certainty with which actors are willing to attribute events in the stock market to various world events. And in that workshop, I've gotten a sense of sort of what economists are up to when they look at text data. And some of this, I think, might be a little bit sociological. So for a variety of maybe accidental reasons, computer scientists and political scientists were a bit closer together and able to collaborate. Some of this is about the sort of nature of political science, where political scientists are very close to laws and text. And so it was perhaps a little bit easier to incorporate into our line of work. And, you know, some of this I do think comes back to this idea of thinking about whether we can even define bias for some estimators, and which we argue is not possible for things like unsupervised. And I think perhaps that was a little bit friendlier in political science than economics, but I want to be clear that there's a number of economists who are doing fantastic work using text as data and using it to study a wide range of things, you know, movements in financial markets and sort of the behavior of various companies. There's a long history of using text as data to study 401k report or 10K, not 401k, 10K reports for companies. So I think, you know, 4 years from now, economists will claim that they've dominated political science in this.
Well, that is based on past performance, that would be the outcome that I would expect. But that's good. I'm glad you've now at least justified. So by sharing your secrets on this New Books in Economics channel, you've now hastened the day when the imperialists will come and conquer your territory. But I appreciate you sharing, because after all, we're all supposed to be in it for the love of knowledge and developing a social science. And this book is so, again, the title of the book is Text as Data. You know, encourage anyone, you know, even if you haven't been using text as data, I think this is, it's a thick book. I admit, I can see why took you guys a while, because you really thought through a lot of different things. And so there's a lot to get through there. But I think it is even, you know, at an introductory level, just like trying to figure out like, what is going on and what tools might I be wanting to pick up, or, you know, for, you know, even someone, let's say older and lazier, like what tools might I want to have my grad student pick up so that we can like study something new. Even if, you know, I can't program anymore or whatever. It's a very useful handbook for understanding like how it all works, and what it's for. So congratulations. It's a great book, and, I encourage everyone listening. I probably, if you've gotten this far on the podcast, you're definitely the kind of person who wants to read this book. So you should go do it.